Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on Radio MD iHeart or wherever you download us from. Thank you for doing that. We're brought to you, as usual, for this segment, 1241B. The Bs are always great guests. Dr. Raven is not only one of, but is the world authority, probably on Alzheimer's disease, because he is the first professor at Hopkins that was devoted to that. He is currently a professor emeritus in the departments of psychiatry and medicine at Hopkins, and an MD, MPH, and clearly has written the book that is one of, by far, the best books ever in this field, The 36-Hour Day, a national New York Times bestseller. This book is that we'll be talking about today is It Alzheimer's? 101 Answers, obviously, to different questions, and we'll give him some questions as well. But first, we're brought to you by LifesFirstNaturals.com, the makers of Truebiotics and Bovine Colostrum. Go to their website, LifesFirstNaturals, with an S.com. See the double-blind randomized trials on those medications and why they're really supplements. They're over-the-counter, and why I believe that almost all of us over the age of 50 should consider them. As well as longevityplaybook.com. Sign up for the free newsletter at longevityplaybook.com. Dr. Raven's Alzheimer's disease, we just learned that today or yesterday in the article that it wasn't 5 million, but it's 7 million Americans are now having this. And I assume with the new blood tests, we're going to be able to get the diagnosis earlier. Is that right? Is that what's expected?
Yes, it's expected. I think first to help us be much more accurate. And then second, I think, yes, we will be able to detect the disease earlier.
What do people expect? Is that going to be a routine test, or do you think we'll only have to request it by individuals? Will it increase anxiety? Will it increase early treatment? What do you expect to happen over the next 5 years?
Well, I think at least at the beginning, we're only going to test people who clearly have some difficulty with memory. So it will not be a universal test at the beginning. We really don't yet know how will it operate in that way. So I think going forward, the diagnosis is going to require both some clinical evidence of memory or thinking impairment, plus a positive blood test or PET brain scan.
Now, you in this book have a wonderful, simple way of putting things. This is a great book. Is It Alzheimer's? 101 Answers to Your Most Pressing Questions About Memory Loss and Dementia. It's a wonderful book. And part of it is, when I see patients over the age of 50, almost universally, if you ask them, are you worried about your memory? It is the vast majority, I would guess 70%, say yes, and what can I do? So how common is memory loss? Is it inevitable as we get older? I assume not everyone has memory loss, because you clearly don't have it. As my listeners know, I'm 79 now and don't have it yet either. So is it inevitable?
I don't think so, but beginning around age 35 or 40, it is universal, so inevitable in that way, that everybody has a little bit of greater difficulty recalling words and names. Now, it starts, it's very subtle, but when you're in your 50s and 60s, most people notice that words just don't come as quickly as they used to. Same with names. The way I think it's helpful to think about it is, if I were to give all your listeners a test in which I said, let me give you 10 words, I want you to say them back to me, and then we'll wait a few minutes, we'll have a conversation, and I'll come back and ask you, tell me as many of those words as you can. The average 35-year-old would remember about 7.5 on average words. The average 75-year-old would remember 6.5 So that's a real difference. And it's a statistically, when you test thousands of people, it's a very, very strong finding. But if you tested people with early Alzheimer's disease, they might get three of those words. So the difference is huge between 6.5 and 3. And that's people with very mild disease. So I think we do need to separate normal aging from Alzheimer's.
One of the things you bring up is not all memory loss is Alzheimer's. There's an early state that we've called MCI, if you will, and I'm going to let you define that. And what percent of those go on to develop further memory loss? And when I find out, in other words, if I look at my reaction time, I test my reaction time on a thing called Brain HQ, freeze frame and double decision every Saturday. And I noticed from 10 years ago, when they first had it available till now, my reaction time has declined, even though I practice. And is reaction time a good way of looking at this?
Well, you've just touched on the second universal change with aging. The first is it's harder to come up with words and names. And the second is that brain processing does seem to slow down modestly the older we get. And that's really what reaction time is measuring. So what you're reporting is a normal aging finding. We don't really know the basis of it. But again, that's quite distinct from dementias, which impair thinking, not just memory, but all thinking in general. So to define MCI, or mild cognitive impairment, it's a person who has difficulty usually in only one aspect of thinking, and memory is by far the most common, that doesn't interfere with their everyday functioning. They have measurable memory impairment when they're given a test, but it doesn't yet affect how they function every day. So you asked about what percentage of people then go on to have true dementia or perhaps Alzheimer's disease. At 1 year follow-up, about 10% of those people will have progressed to dementia. And that is cumulative, so it's really 10% every year. So by 5 years after a diagnosis, about 50% of people with MCI have developed dementia. On the other hand, if you go back to the first 1 year follow-up, about 25% of people have actually reverted to normal, meaning they had a bad day, they had a cold, they might have taken a little bit too much medication, they didn't get a good night's sleep. So just falling into that category on one day, we have to be cautious on what that might predict in the future.
Now, we know a lot of effort has been spent on drugs and drug therapies for Alzheimer's without much benefit. And I don't know if you're familiar with the AMBAR studies. I assume you are, since you're a master of this. But the AMBAR studies seem to say that therapeutic plasma exchange would benefit cognitive dysfunction in Alzheimer's. And I've often wondered why this hasn't gained more approval. It's a technique that we use for many autoimmune diseases. Although it seems less expensive, less side effects, and more effective than the current monoclonal antibodies. Why do you think we aren't seeing that used more?
I think the challenge is, who are we including in these studies? One of the problems is that when we clinically have diagnosed Alzheimer's in the past, doctors have been wrong somewhere between 30 to 10% of the time. So the best clinicians seem to be right about 90%, but if you just go into general medicine, doctors are only right about 60% of the time. So that means something else is going on. And we do know that many of these dementias have inflammation as a part of the disease. So trials of other forms of anti-inflammation haven't so far really been successful, but it may be that there's a more universal underlying pathology in a lot of these diseases, in part that they trigger inflammation, which then may make the brain destruction process go a little bit quicker. And, you know, plasma exchange really is a way to diminish that.
Got it. The other thing that I learned from the RUVO Center, the Cleveland Clinic has this large RUVO Center for dementias and, if you will, other neurologic diseases that are disabling, is that the caregivers often suffer a great deal in this process. And I noticed you were very careful in the way you use the word caregiver. Tell us a little more about caregivers and their risks.
Well, this has really been a career-long interest, and the reason we wrote both The 36-Hour Day and this newer book, Is It Alzheimer's, is in part to help people with the disease, but in large part to help the caregivers, because there's a large body of research to show that caregivers experience much higher rates of distress than the normal population. And in fact, in a study that I was involved with out in Utah called the Cache County Study, where we prospectively followed, 90% of the people in the county who are over 65, so it's a really good sample, we found that caregivers actually are at higher risk of themselves developing dementia than people who are the same age and not caregivers. So not for everybody, but for many people, caregiving is quite stressful. And I want to always emphasize, though, that there's a lot that we can do to support both the person with the disease and the caregivers.
One of the problems that you go into in the book, and again, we're talking about the book, Is It Alzheimer's? 101 Answers to Your Most Pressing Questions About Memory Loss and Dementia, the second edition by Peter Rabins, R-A-B-I-N-S, M-D, M-P-H, who is the first professor and chair, named chair of psychiatry and specifically into the Alzheimer's problem. I'll give you the name of the chair. He was the Richmond Family Professorship for Alzheimer's and Related Diseases at Hopkins and is now a professor in medicine and psychiatry as a emeritus at Hopkins. As I said, still active, not only in writing, but in paying taxes and paying into Social Security. But one of the things you do talk about is what I would call the de-inhibition, and that's probably the wrong word, but is some of the violent or behavior or what you would call aberrant behavior of late Alzheimer's. And are there newer drugs to help with that?
So disinhibition, which is, you know, loss of inhibitions, can be seen in many brain diseases. We think that it's due to loss of frontal lobe function. We think the frontal lobes are, in a sense, the social part of the brain that tells us when to talk, when not to talk, when to get very upset, maybe when to control it a little bit. And clearly, that's damaged, not in everybody, but in some people, not just with Alzheimer's disease, but with other dementias as well. There have been a number of clinical trials trying different medications. A few are modestly helpful. In other words, they're better than a placebo. And in general, they decrease the frequency of emotional distress or outbursts. Rarely do they make it totally go away. So there are really a variety of medicines that can help some. But in fact, I think changing the environment around the person is more powerful than the medications. And there are a few studies to show that as well. So if the person's getting distressed, to immediately stop what you're doing, you learn to recognize what's coming. You can distract them, take them away from whatever it is that's triggering it. If you talk to them in a calm way, tell them that you're in control of things, nothing bad's going to happen. There are many things like that that one can do. And if you learn in the environment what are the triggers, and then you take those away, say it's a lot of noise or getting visited by four grandkids at once, well, then you only have one come over. If you learn what those triggers are, you can also decrease the likelihood that those disinhibited or so-called catastrophic reactions will occur.
What it sounds like is you believe the environment change is more powerful than any of the antipsychotic or calming drugs.
Yes, I would say that's accurate, yes.
So we've been talking, and unfortunately I could talk forever and ask questions forever because this is a important subject for all of us. I do longevity medicine and the early avoidance of dementia, if you will. is my goal at the Cleveland Clinic, but we've been talking with the expert on memory loss and Alzheimer's, Peter Rabins, R-A-B-I-N-S. I'm probably mispronouncing the name. It's Rabins, I think. But in any case, he's an MD, MPH, the professor emeritus in the Department of Psychiatry and Medicine at Johns Hopkins. The book is It Alzheimer's? It's kind of a follow-up and important adjunct to the best-selling author of The 36-Hour Day, which I think is the best book in this field. I've got a couple last questions, if you will, that I got tweeted in here as people listen to what I'm doing. And one of them said, you haven't asked him about Parkinson's disease at all. One of the items I should say is you do go into the differentiation of this versus other dementias in the book, such as you talk about frontotemporal and Lewy body, etc., and a little bit about Parkinson's. The question is the condition of Parkinson's similar to this? What are the major differences they asked me to ask you?
Interestingly enough, when I started my career, most neurologists thought that Parkinson's disease did not cause dementia. It's just that people were so slowed down that they appeared to have dementia. When L-DOPA as a treatment came along, and it was a miraculous treatment, it became clear that some people who were physically, motorically improved clearly had underlying cognitive impairments. The difference between the cognitive impairment of Alzheimer's disease and that of Parkinson's disease is that there's several, but one of them is that in Alzheimer's disease, people develop aphasia, like the aphasia we see in stroke. And usually that develops from 3 to 6 years after the first memory symptoms develop. In Parkinson's disease, we don't see aphasia, the language disorder of aphasia per se. That's one difference. The second difference is that in Parkinson's dementia, people develop so-called visual spatial impairment. They can't see the world correctly. They can't copy things like interlocking pentagons and boxes, 3D boxes, the kinds of things we sort of learned in school to do much earlier than the impairments and visual spatial function develop in Alzheimer's. So the real difference is we think that this is related to the fact that the diseases start in different places in the brain and progress differently. You know, toward the end of the disease, all these diseases look similar, but the initiation of the disease, the proteins that are involved in causing the impairment are quite different. I will say that because most people with Parkinson's disease are elderly, about half of people with Parkinson's and dementia also have Alzheimer's changes in their brain. So sometimes we're not sure whether it's pure Parkinson's dementia, Parkinson's plus Alzheimer's dementia. And then you have the other category of Lewy body dementia, which is more of a Parkinsonian-like dementia, but the dementia there starts at about the same time as the physical motoric slowing. So that's where Lewy body is somewhat different. The last thing I'll say is that in Lewy body dementia, somewhere between 70 and 80% of people have visual hallucinations. And these are less common in Parkinson's dementia and even less common in Alzheimer's.
I want to thank you. Is It Alzheimer's? A great book. It's going to stay on my bookshelf, as has the 36-Hour Day book. Thank you very much for doing this work and for sharing it with us. Is It Alzheimer's is available. It's a Johns Hopkins Press health book. And we are, as usual, sponsored by LifesFirstNaturals.com, makers of TrueBiotics, Bovine Colostrum, as well as LongevityPlaybook.com. One last question, Dr. Rabins, that with earlier diagnosis due to the blood tests, will we see earlier treatment and success in the treatment? What's your best guess for 5 years from now?
I think 5 years from now, we're going to have a few new drugs, some of which work in different mechanisms than the two monoclonals that are already available. And I think this is going to be like cancer therapeutics, where, you know, for many diseases, we need four different drugs that have different targets. And I think it's very likely in Alzheimer's that we're going to need multiple drugs to treat multiple targets in the disease. And I think going forward, I think we're going to have progress in identifying those other treatments. And I think by 5 years, we'll just be seeing some of those emerge.
So if we can make it 5 years, we're likely to be able to be treated successfully or semi-successfully for this. That's the prediction. I'm glad we're ending on a great note. Thank you, our audience, for downloading this. This has been 1241B. The Bs are always great guests like we've had today. The As, the latest medical news of the week and what it means to you. And we had a great set of medical news items this week. Thanks again. We'll be back next week. We hope you are too.